سعد بن مسعود that let's give Imam al-Hassan alayhi salam to Muawiyah so that we can keep our position. Now Ayatollah Khoui, who is one of the scholars who admire Mukhtar a lot, he says that first of all this narration is mursal, it doesn't have an authentic chain of the narration, and second of all, maybe Mukhtar was not serious in his suggestion. He wanted to somehow test and try his uncle. The same is has been mentioned by Sayyid Muhsin Amin. In another narration, it's been mentioned that Mukhtar will go to the hellfire, but he will be Imam Hussein alayhi salam will intercede for him, and he will go to paradise. According to some scholars, this is a weak narration. Now, you see, we have these narrations which somehow they are contradicting each other, and that is why we have different viewpoints by Shia scholars, and in each group we have big names. Mm-hmm. Among those people who support Mukhtar Thaqafi and his uprising, and they believe that it was with the permission of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, we can mention scholars like Ibn al-Mahili. He says that the words of the Imam of the Ahlul Bayt, which talk about him in a positive manner and they have prayed for him, it's a sign that he was a righteous person with good intention. As I mentioned, the late Mamakani, he says that he believed in the imamate of the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt, and he says that in one case, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam sends Rahmah upon him three times, and it's enough for us to come to this conclusion that he was a righteous person.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir. Inshallah, inshallah,
inshallah, you'll find your way. Allama Hilli also discusses about that. So my point is that during the history, different Shia scholars, they have talked about this issue. Mm-hmm. The Allama Hilli, finally, he prefers the narrations which admire him over the narrations which, reprimand him. Among the contemporary scholars, some of them, they have talked about this issue. I can refer to Ayatollah Khoui and Allama Amini. They also prefer the narrations of madh or admiration.
Crazy.
Yeah. And Ayatollah Khoui, for example, he says that the uprising of Mukhtar was with the permission of Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam. Again, Allama Amini, he believes that three imams, that is Imam Sajjad, Imam Baqir, and Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, they have sent blessings upon Mukhtar, and it's a good sign that he was a righteous person. Mm-hmm. Then we have a group of scholars that somehow they have stopped giving their viewpoint about this issue.
Yeah.
So again, it is another sign that it's a pretty complicated issue. So much so that some of the great scholars, they have stopped giving a final conclusion about him. For example, Mirza Muhammad Astarabadi, he says that we are not allowed to talk bad against Mukhtar, but the narrations talking about his virtues cannot be trusted. So finally he says that I'm not able to decide about this issue.
Okay.
And also we can mention a great scholar like Allama Majlisi. He says that the faith of Mukhtar was not complete, and his uprising was without the permission of Imam, but because of the fact that he did a lot of good actions, maybe he will reach salvation. So finally he says that we are I also prefer not to give a final conclusion about
it. Is there any reference to the basis that he reached to this conclusion?
Yes, in Bihar al-Anwar he has talked in details about this. He has evaluated different narrations. You know, the point is that let me give a reason for some of these scholars. And today in our contemporary time, we see that, of course, most of the scholars, they believe that Mukhtar was a very righteous person, and he wasn't, looking for power. Somehow he had the permission of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam. But again, we have few Shia scholars who do not agree with that. We have different points. One point is that when it is time for taqiyya, which is roughly translated as dissimulation, it is very difficult to come to a kind of conclusion. Mm-hmm. For example, we have a personality like Zurara. Mm-hmm. We know how great he is and what a great role he played in spreading the Islamic teachings. But for such a person, we have some narrations against him.
Yeah.
So what is the, what is the point? The point is that
he was at the time of taqiyya.
Yeah, the imams were living in a time that they thought that maybe Zurara might be killed by the caliphs of the time. So they said some narrations against him so that, those people come to this understanding that Zurara is not a true companion of the imam. That is why imam, for example, is saying some bad words against him. Maybe the same is true about Mukhtar al-Thaqafi. Imam Sajjad alayhi salam is living under the very difficult situation. And he is not able, some scholars argue, he is not able to directly mention that I'm supporting Mukhtar, otherwise his life would be in danger. Mm-hmm. That is why, according to some narration, he mentions to some of his companions that Muhammad bin Hanafiya is my representative in this uprising, so that the Umayyad Caliphate may not consider Imam as the leader of this uprising, rather they consider Muhammad bin Hanafiya as the leader. So this may have brought about some complication, and
maybe he wanted to bring a sort of immunity for Imam Sajjad alayhi salam.
That's the point. So those scholars who agree with the uprising of Mukhtar, they say that the uprising of Mukhtar was with the permission of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, but because Imam Sajjad alayhi salam wanted to practice taqiyya, he was not, religiously speaking, allowed to publicly and directly support Mukhtar, and that is why he appointed Muhammad bin Hanafiya. But the other group of scholars, they refer to some narrations which are against Mukhtar. The scholars who are pro-Mukhtar, they say that maybe they are weak, or they were mentioned in the state of taqiyya. Imam mentions that I'm against Mukhtar so that his life would not be endangered by the rulers of the time. Mm-hmm. Some scholars believe that no, Imam mentioned that not in the state of taqiyya. And we have the same problem in some other issues. So that is one of the reasons that I believe that we have these contradicting narrations. Imam is in the state of taqiyya. He's not able to directly lead the uprising. Maybe he says some narrations against Mukhtar.
Yeah.
And it causes some people to, come to a kind of confusion about him. And the same is true about belief in the imamate of Muhammad bin Hanafiya. Those scholars who are pro-Mukhtar, they believe that this is not the case. Imam Sajjad alayhi salam himself chose Muhammad bin Hanafiya as his representative, but those who are against Mukhtar, they say that no, he did not refer to Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, rather he referred to Muhammad bin Hanafiya.
Thank you very much, dear Sheikh. Yeah, very true. So we need to imagine ourselves in the time that these issues actually had happened, to imagine the political situation, the status of Imam Sajjad and Muhammad bin Hanafiya at those times, to see if they were allowed or they had this freedom to say freely about Mukhtar or not. So we need to consider the conditions that the Imam and and the Mukhtar himself actually were in. So for such studies, as you rightly mentioned, evaluation actually requires to see different factors and elements and to reach to a good conclusion. Anyhow, all in all, what we have understood from your explanations, Mukhtar actually, to some extent, is approved, and his personality actually has been praised by Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. But this is not something quite certain, and it needs to be looked at with
some caution. The final point is that, I mean, as I mentioned, somehow, especially in our time, maybe most of the scholars, they, I mean, support Mukhtar and his uprising. But it doesn't mean that whatever he did in his uprising is confirmed
because
by the religion of Islam.
There is no infallibility behind
he's not infallible. So maybe in some of the cases he has done some extreme actions. So the fact that his uprising is approved, even if we accept that, it doesn't mean that whatever he did what he is confirmed by the Imam of the Ahlul Bid'ah.
Thank you very much, dear Sheikh, and your respected listeners for your staying tuned and listening to Q&A in Islamic Beliefs. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
إن في الجنة نهر اللبن إن في الجنة نهر اللبن علي وحسين وحسن
يوسف جلالي تهران
روبا شافت غازا
جيروم هيوز بروسلز
سعيد بورزا لندن
Russia, Saglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Afghanistan's Deputy Minister of Information and Culture, Zabihullah Mujahid, says the United States has violated the country's airspace by its drones. He accused Washington of violating all international law, as well as a U.S.-Taliban peace deal signed between the two sides. He said the violations must be controlled and prevented.
Daesh presence in Afghanistan is not a big headache for us. Our forces are capable to uproot them here without receiving any foreign support. So the U.S. must honor Doha deal and stop violating our space.
Mujahid's statement followed remarks by Pentagon spokesman John Kirby. He said the U.S. retained all necessary authorities to execute over-the-horizon counter-terrorism operations. Kirby also said Washington remains confident in its capabilities moving forward without speaking to specific rules of engagement surrounding airstrikes. He said there is currently no requirement to clear airspace with the Taliban. Analysts say since the U.S. did not fulfill its commitments to Afghanistan over the past 20 years, it is not expected to honor other pacts like U.S.-Taliban Doha deal.
Violating Afghanistan's sovereignty is not a new move by the U.S. It has repeatedly broken its promises, mainly when it comes to respecting our country's sovereignty, even during the rule of former governments here.
Given the U.S. is insisting on continuation of drone strikes in Afghanistan without coordination with the Taliban, the group has also warned the U.S. of negative consequences of continuing violation of Afghanistan's airspace. The U.S. claims that it targets terrorist groups like Daesh with its airstrikes. However, evidence on the ground shows that innocent Afghans are usually the real victims of such attacks. One of the last U.S. drone strikes was in Kabul on August 29 and killed 10 members of a family, including 6 children. Sayed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Just tip of the iceberg on how humiliatingly the Taliban defeated the U.S. in Afghanistan's battlefield. The Pentagon now has finally made admission of its failures, which enabled the Taliban to take over the entire Afghanistan so swiftly.
We need to consider some uncomfortable truths, that we didn't anticipate the snowball effect caused by the deals that the Taliban commanders struck with local leaders in the wake of the Doha Agreement, and that the Doha Agreement itself had a demoralizing effect on Afghan soldiers. And finally, that we failed to grasp that there was only so much for which and for whom many of the Afghan forces would fight. The fact that the Afghan army that we and our partners trained simply melted away, in many cases without firing a shot, took us all by surprise.
If today the world needs to know why the Taliban are back in power, all the world has to do is do a deep analysis of why 300,000 well-equipped Afghan army give up without a fight.
Contrary to what Pentagon admitted, before the U.S. Senate Armed Service Committee. As many as 22 Republican senators introduced a bill in the Senate to probe the role of regional countries with particular focus on Pakistan in the military defeat of U.S.-led NATO troops in Afghanistan. The bill proposes sanctions on regional countries, particularly Pakistan and nascent Taliban government in Kabul. After Afghanistan, Pakistan has suffered the most. Tens of thousands of people died. An estimated $250 billion losses occur to the economy in the long-drawn retaliatory insurgency in Pakistan for supporting a U.S. war on Afghanistan.
The only reason we suffered so much was because we became an ally of the U.S., of the coalition, in the war against Afghanistan, where there were attacks being conducted from Afghan soil into Pakistan. At least there should have been a word of appreciation. But rather than appreciation, imagine how we feel when we are blamed for this, the turn of events in Afghanistan.
Pakistan sounded disappointed with what it called the ungratefulness of the West for ignoring its sacrifices in a war which people here always believed was not their war. Analysts believe that Islamabad is likely to get further closer to China and become part of the efforts to build up a bloc of regional countries in the event of U.S. economic sanctions on Pakistan. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
It was the biggest state intervention in the UK's labor market since World War II, introduced 18 months ago to help firms weather the economic storm whipped up by the pandemic. Popularly known as the furlough scheme, it's cost a whopping $94 billion. Without it, there are concerns that the job market will be flooded as job seekers need to find employment.
The young people in particular not doing well in this, but anybody on the borderline of low-paid jobs or into welfare benefit or an element of welfare benefit in their income, they are going to be hit very, very badly indeed.
Launched in March last year, the scheme was the brainchild of British Chancellor Rishi Sunak, covering 80% of a furloughed employee's wages. When it started, it helped save more than 11 million jobs. 18 months later, it was still supporting well over a million of them. The government is hopeful that the more than a million job vacancies will absorb workers coming off furlough. Critics say the decision to wind up the scheme will only intensify Britain's economic woes.
And there's going to be about 1.6 million people who are going to be unemployed, losing their jobs. And they will not be able to find jobs necessarily in other sectors of the economy. There are several reasons for that. Partly there's a lack of skills matching, and also because the conditions of the virus taught people how bad so many of the jobs were. They were not full-time jobs. They were temporary, insecure, low-paid jobs. And a lot of people do not want to go back to those situations.
But it's not just the ending of the furlough that is a concern among Britons. A temporary increase in welfare payments, universal credit, and a moratorium on evictions for renters squeezed by the pandemic are also ending in October, at a time when consumers are facing a 12% rise in energy costs.
And all of that happening at a time when the country's economic recovery from COVID-19 is faltering, as announced by the Bank of England's governor just this week. And what that means for the people in Britain is that an autumn storm is on the way. Saeed Pourreza, London.
The funeral prayers for one of the eight members of the Islamic movement killed by the Nigerian security forces was attended by aggrieved members. The movement said the eight were cut down and killed when security operatives opened fire with live rounds during a peaceful trek of the Arba'in, an annual religious event undertaken by members of the Islamic movement.
They killed about eight people, which we are sure that, as they used to do normally, after they kill, they will carry the dead body away. So also the same thing yesterday, they carried away the dead bodies. It is only one of our Muslim brothers by name Shamsuddin Abdurrahman we were able to take away from them.
The Nigerian police have denied that any member was killed during what they describe as a provocative trek. Press TV visited a health facility where many injured victims of the attack were receiving treatment from bullet wounds. Members of the Islamic movement have continued to express outrage at the persistent attacks by security forces whenever they come out for religious events.
The security agent in Nigeria, they have been paid. They paid their salary and they provide them with weapons to protect the life and properties of the citizens. But in these days, they are using these weapons to attack the citizens that they are supposed to protect. Our offense to the government of this country is just coming out to practice our religion the way we understand it.
In a statement, Amnesty International has expressed grave concern over the murder of the 8 members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria. It called on the Nigerian authorities to put an end to the deadly crackdown on members of the Islamic movement, which it says has been going on since December 2015. Danjum Abdullahi, Abuja.
Presidents of Russia and Turkey held their face-to-face talks since the beginning of pandemic. After the talks, the two leaders confirmed that the mutual ties developed positively despite some problems.
Our negotiations are not always easy, but with a positive final result, our departments have learned compromises that are beneficial to both sides.
Syria was among the main topics of talks between the two leaders. In Syria, Russia serves as the main supporter of the Syrian government, while Turkey backs anti-government groups. Despite this, the two countries have been cooperating in seeking a political solution in the country.
Peace in the Syrian region depends on Turkish-Russian relations. Our joint steps on the Syrian issue are of great importance. The steps we have already taken were correct and cannot be changed.
Last year, Turkey and Russia reached a ceasefire agreement to put an end to war in Syria's Idlib. Turkey is concerned that an escalation of violence in northern Syria may lead to a new influx of refugees across its borders.
The two sides have to make a balanced relation when it comes to Syria, but it is not an easy task amid plots by the US and its allies. For example, the US did not object to the delivery of humanitarian supplies to Syria through the territory controlled by the Syrian troops, and this was done with an attempt to knock Russia and Turkey head on.
The talks between Erdogan and Putin came after U.S. President Joe Biden refused to grant a one-on-one meeting with his Turkish counterpart on the sidelines of the United Nations General Assembly.
Another pressing issue in Russian-Turkish cooperation is Ankara's purchase of Russian S-400 missile systems. On the eve of his visit to Sochi, Erdogan told reporters that he rejects any foreign pressure regarding this issue and intends to go ahead with his decision to the system. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Some major international humanitarian agencies are warning about the consequences of the economic crisis in Afghanistan due to widespread joblessness, poverty, and U.S. sanctions on the country. Either war or unemployment has forced Hamid and hundreds of other families to flee their homes and get to Kabul in search of a better life. But contrary to their expectations, they are living here in this camp in northern Kabul for the internally displaced. They are living dire conditions and deprived of basic services.
We left our village in Baghlan province after the escalation of clashes back in July. Now we are living here while we have no access to our basic needs, such as portable water, electricity, or healthcare services. Hundreds of people here are suffering from malnutrition as well.
Abdullah is another internally displaced man who also lives here with his family members. He says nor the Taliban, neither humanitarian aid agencies have so far met their needs. Therefore, he asks for implementation of a transparent supporting plan for people like himself and the rest of vulnerable Afghans who are suffering from hunger and malnutrition.
Humanitarian aid should be distributed among the neediest families like us. But so far, we have seen that most of those who are in charge of handing out humanitarian assistance are corrupt figures because they usually distribute the aid among their own relatives and friends.
Under such circumstances, the Taliban administration has also called on the international community and humanitarian aid agencies to resume their aid supplies to Afghanistan. This comes as some neighboring countries of Afghanistan, like Iran and Pakistan, have begun sending humanitarian aid to Kabul, a move that is widely welcomed by both the Taliban and ordinary Afghans, especially the internally displaced ones.
A rise in the number of internally displaced people has put pressure on Afghanistan. Moreover, Afghans are already denied access to their assets, as Washington has frozen them under the name of slapping sanctions on the Taliban. However, facts on the ground show that Washington's move has affected the lives of ordinary Afghans, especially internally displaced people, rather than affecting the Taliban. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Russia has warned NATO against setting up military infrastructure in Ukraine. It comes after Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko said the United States is creating military bases in Ukraine under the guise of establishing training centers. Lukashenko said he has discussed the issue with his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, and they agreed to take action to counter the growing NATO activity.
It's actions that will provide for the strategic interests and security of our two allied states. The issue of potential expansion of NATO military infrastructure in Ukraine was numerously mentioned by President Putin, and President Putin said it was beyond the red line he had talked about repeatedly.
Moscow has time and again warned against NATO's expansion in Ukraine, saying it is a red line the West will regret crossing. Last week, Russia held large-scale joint military drills with Belarus. The maneuvers followed Ukraine's joint war games with the U.S. and other NATO member states. Tensions have been simmering between Moscow and Kiev since the ouster of Ukraine's elected president Viktor Yanukovych in a U.S.-backed revolt in 2014. The tensions further escalated after Crimea declared autonomy from Ukraine to reunite with the Russian Federation. The so-called revolution in Ukraine and Kiev's subsequent reach out to NATO could be part of a puzzle being pieced together by the United States and its allies to contain Russia militarily.
Yemen is half condemned what the Iraqi government has described as an illegal meeting held in Iraq's semi-autonomous Kurdistan region. The meeting demanded Baghdad join the so-called Abraham Accords and normalize ties with Israel.
We believe in the rights of the Palestinian people to liberate their land, and therefore we will stand against any attempt to normalize relations with Israel. The recent illegal meeting in the Iraqi city of Erbil is completely rejected. It's a desperate attempt after the failure of the so-called deal of the century. Palestine will be liberated and Israelis will be expelled.
Yemen's Prime Minister Abdulaziz bin Habtour slammed the meeting, saying it is an attempt to drag the free people of Iraq to normalize relations with the Israeli regime, adding those who have normalized ties with Israel are part of the Zionist project in the region.
The normalization meeting that was held in Erbil, Iraq, is an attempt to drag the Iraqi people into normalization with the Israeli enemy and for Iraq to become part of the Zionist project, as some Arab rulers did last year. But the conference failed and was rejected by all the free and resistance forces in Iraq because it is a betrayal of the Palestinian cause and the Islamic nation.
The so-called Abraham Accords is a U.S.-led Middle East initiative aimed at establishing diplomatic relations and full normalization between Arab countries and the Israeli regime. This agreement was signed by Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, Morocco, and Sudan, and was welcomed by Israeli officials.
Yemenis have praised the Iraqi government's rejection of normalization of ties with Israel. They say the free people of the world will always support the Palestinian cause until the liberation of the occupied territories. Abdulatif Washali, Sana'a.
Prominent cleric Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki is the leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, known as the IMN. The top Muslim cleric and his supporters have been subject to a crackdown by Nigerian authorities over the past years. The most brutal attack took place in December 2015 in the northern city of Zaria, Kaduna State. The army opened fire on Zakzaki's supporters, killing hundreds, including three of his sons. The military accused the Sheikh's supporters of having tried to stop the passing convoy of the army chief to assassinate him. The IMN vehemently denied that accusation. During the crackdown, Sheikh Zakzaki and his wife suffered gunfire wounds. They were taken into custody under the pretext of protecting them from violence in Zaria. But they were later charged with culpable homicide, unlawful assembly, and disruption of public peace, among other things. A year later, the Abuja High Court ordered their release, but the Nigerian government defied the order. Sheikh Zakzaki and his wife remained in prison until July 28th this year, when they were released after a Kaduna High Court dismissed all charges against them. The IMN welcomed the ruling, saying it is a victory of perseverance in the face of extreme persecution. Kaduna state officials later acknowledged in a report that the military had acted disproportionately in connection with Sheikh Zakzaki and the Zaria massacre, and that the soldiers involved should be punished. No one has so far been prosecuted over the incident.
British government considering sending in army personnel in an effort to alleviate the fuel crisis that has seen back-to-back queues or empty forecourts across the UK over the past days. Drivers across the capital especially have been involved in a desperate game of trying to beat their neighbour to a petrol station that was still lucky enough to have some fuel left.
I basically just ran out of fuel, but I've been trying several of them, and then everyone just been shutting down. So it's quite bad, really. You know, I mean, I never thought, you know, I mean, we're going to run out of fuel. I thought maybe one day we're going to run out of food, but not of fuel.
This morning, we are supposed to have a delivery, because due to shortage of drivers, you couldn't get a delivery. It has been postponed till tonight now. To be honest with you, since the Brexit, this thing has happened, like, you know. A lot of drivers have gone back home, like, and hence, there is a shortage in the haulage industry.
It's empty forecourts like these that will no doubt be causing political anxiety for the government. But none will be more stressed than the British consumer, who might be wondering where might they get the next full tank in order to make it to school, to make it to work, to make it through the day.
The Transport Secretary, Grant Shapps, is keen to describe this not as a crisis exacerbated by Brexit, but one manufactured by the haulier industry, who says they need over 100,000 extra drivers to meet current need. There's also been a degree of blame placed at the feet of the consumers for panic buying and driving up demand unnecessarily.
There's no shortage of the fuel within the country. So the most important thing is actually that if people carry on as they normally would and fill up their cars when they normally would, then you won't have queues and you won't have shortages at the pump either.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson has already announced a three-month visa scheme to tempt experienced EU HGV drivers back to the UK to assist until Christmas, and the role the army could play is also being explored.
We are bringing MOD trainers in to accelerate some of the HGV training. We've to clear a backlog of people who want to carry out those tests, so there's definitely a role there for the MOD.
In the meantime, consumers want to guarantee that they are not left stranded, and if that means driving miles in search of the precious fuel, it's a journey they're willing to make. Amina Taylor, London.
This is IRIB English Radio.
website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
U.S. Congress passed a bill to fund the government into December, but questions remain over the debt ceiling and President Joe Biden's agenda. We now present you an article written by David Smith. The piece is titled, "The U.S. Government Avoided a Shutdown, But What Happens Next?" The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. The U.S. government went into Thursday, 30th of September, embroiled in a game of three-dimensional chess, with time running out and trillions of dollars at stake. The first dimension was a must-do: fund the government by midnight to avoid it shutting down. In a typical shutdown, hundreds of thousands of federal employees stop getting paid, and many stop working. Some services are suspended, and numerous national attractions and national parks temporarily close. The second dimension is an even bigger must-do: raise the national debt ceiling, an artificially imposed borrowing limit before an estimated deadline of 18th of October. Failure to pay its bills would see the U.S. default for the first time in history. The House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, has warned that the effects would be cataclysmic and cost 6 million jobs. The third dimension is not quite a must, but it feels that way to Joe Biden and the Democrats. Pass a $1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure bill and a $3.5 trillion partisan package that expands social services and tackles the climate crisis. Both are stalled by divisions between Democratic centrists and progressives, along with Republican eagerness to deny President Biden a win. The U.S. government's power is spread across the executive, the president, legislative, that means Congress, and judicial, or Supreme Court and other court branches, which ensures checks and balances, but can also get messy quickly. While Democrats hold the presidency and both chambers of Congress, their margins in the latter are razor thin. The Senate is evenly split 50-50, with the Vice President Kamala Harris holding the tiebreaker vote. Democrats have a 220 to 212 margin in the House of Representatives, so can only afford a handful of defections. Comparisons between President Biden and Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal in the 1930s were therefore somewhat fanciful, since Roosevelt enjoyed much more comfortable majorities to rubber-stamp his priorities. Joe Biden has the power of persuasion, but not much else. So first things first, will the government shut down at midnight? No, so breathe a sigh of relief. Congress avoided a partial federal shutdown on Thursday, 30th of September, when the Senate and House passed a bill to keep the government funded through to 3rd of December. the stopgap spending bill, which prevented the first shutdown since late 2018, early 2019, provides aid for communities hard hit by hurricanes, wildfires, and other natural disasters, as well as money to help Afghan refugees. But it came at a price, as Democrats were forced to remove language from the bill that would have raised the debt ceiling. Senator Chuck Schumer, the Democratic majority leader in the Senate, said on Thursday, 30th of September, "Just as our Republican colleagues realized that a government shutdown would be catastrophic, they should realize that a default on the national debt would be even worse." Experts predict that the United States would plunge into an instant recession, millions of jobs would be lost, interest rates would soar high, and the stock market would plummet. Mark Zandi, chief economist at Moody's Analytics, told CNN, "It will be financial Armageddon. It's complete craziness to even contemplate the idea of not paying our debt on time. This nightmare, akin to a person running up charges on a credit card and then refusing to pay, can be avoided by giving the Treasury Department additional borrowing authority beyond the current statutory limit of $28.4 trillion. But Senator Mitch McConnell has argued that since Democrats control Congress and the White House, they should pass a debt limit extension with the same budgetary tools they're using to try to pass the $3.5 trillion social and environmental package. Democrats contend this is rank hypocrisy, since the move would cover spending that Congress has already approved, not future investments. Historically, both parties have voted to raise the limit, and Democrats joined the Republican Senate majority in doing so three times during Donald Trump's presidency. Late on Wednesday, 29th of September, the House approved a bill suspending the debt limit through December 2022, but it is expected to be blocked by Senate Republicans. That would mean the threat of default continues to loom. Conventional wisdom holds that the politicians would not surely be willing to drive the country off a cliff, or would they? This is a cornerstone of the Biden agenda, investing $1 trillion in roads, railways, bridges, ports, airports, broadband, internet, and more. On Thursday, 30th of September, the House delayed a scheduled vote on the infrastructure bill that passed the Senate last month in a bipartisan vote, with 19 Republicans voting yes. But since then, House Republicans have been backing away from the bill in a move to deny President Biden a victory. Nancy Pelosi also faces a revolt from an influential group of progressive Democrats who warned she must hold it back until a bigger $3.5 trillion social and environmental investment bill is nailed down. The progressives want Nancy Pelosi to stand by earlier statements that both bills would move through Congress together. They fear that once centrist Democrats have infrastructure in the bag, they will go cold on the bigger commitment. Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, a leader of the House Progressive, said, "We're not blindly trusting that these bills are going to get done in the Senate without actually having that be guaranteed. It is unlikely that Nancy Pelosi will go ahead with the vote unless she's assured of victory." The House Speaker has postponed negotiations until coming days, giving Democrats at least another chance to break the impasse. This would be a once-in-a-generation investment, drawing a line under 40 years of Ronald Reagan's trickle-down economics and potentially transforming millions of lives. The proposed legislation would extend the child tax credit, establish universal pre-K education, and create a federally paid family and medical leave system. It also contains an array of programs to combat the climate crisis and move the country towards renewable energy. The $3.5 trillion plan over 10 years will be paid for by tax increases on the wealthiest Americans and wealthiest corporations. But centrists are pushing for a smaller package, and negotiations on it could stretch for weeks or even longer. It could pass the Senate without Republican votes, though through a process known as reconciliation, but two Democratic senators stand in the way. Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Senator Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona object to the price tag. Senator Manchin said on Wednesday, 29th of September, that spending so much at a time of inflation and a ballooning national debt was the definition of fiscal insanity. President Biden has lobbied both senators, but neither has publicly made clear exactly what they want, much to the frustration of progressives. Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, chair of the House Progressive Caucus, said they need to come up with a counteroffer and then we sit down and negotiate from there. Senator Joe Manchin indicated to reporters on Thursday that he would settle for about a $1.5 trillion, less than half the progressive demands, and unlikely to fly. So the stalemate continues. Never bet against Nancy Pelosi, who pulled off Barack Obama's Affordable Care Act despite internal divisions. But if it does all go wrong, it would be a political disaster for Democrats in general and for President Biden in particular, crashing the Build Back Better agenda on which he ran for re-election against Donald Trump last year. It would also be likely to fuel the sentiment that Washington politicians cannot get anything done. Analysts have warned that Democrats would face a landslide defeat in the midterm elections in November next year, and that President Biden's bid for re-election in 2024 would lie in tatters. His presidency would be all but sunk.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of The Lantern. Wherever you are, I hope you are in a great state of health, wealth, and spirituality. Your heart is filled with content, peace, and submission to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and His decree. Your body is vigorous and strong. Your mind is bright and creative, and your day is going wonderfully. Oftentimes, especially in movies, we find people talking about how life is a journey. It's not necessarily about the destination. Happiness is found through the path that you take to reach it. It's not necessarily this sort of mountain peak that you have to reach in order to feel a certain way within yourself, and that every moment you spend in pursuit of an objective is attaining that objective itself. All of this may be true, but then it all depends on perspective and how we choose to look at life. So one of the topics that actually, never mind, let's listen to a short story regarding this matter, and we're going to be right back.
Mm-hmm.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah. Dear friends, Salaamu Alaikum. So welcome to this episode of Lantern. As usual, we have an interesting story at the beginning of our program. That classic story of the young boy who traveled far from his home to study under a great teacher. When he met the wise old man, his first question was, "How long will it take me before I'm as wise as you?" The response came swiftly, 5 years. "This is a very long time," the boy replied. "How about if I work twice as hard?" "Then it will take 10, said the master. 10? That's far too long. How about if I studied all day and, well, into the night every night?" 15 years, said the sage. "I don't understand," replied the boy. "Every time I promise to devote more energy to my goal, you tell me that it will take longer. Why?" "The answer is simple. With one eye fixed on the destination, there is only one left to guide you along the journey."
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
Gaining knowledge, awareness, enlightenment, insight, wisdom, understanding the meaning of life, whatever it is that you want to call it, definitely is one of those things that falls under the category of the journey to attain it is more important than that ultimate destination itself. Because it is only through the journey of attaining wisdom that we attain wisdom. Does that make sense? It's not like, you know, I can go into a state of comatose for 6 months, wake up next March next year, and then be like, "Oh wow, I feel so much wiser." Any degree of wisdom I can achieve at any point of my life comes with a great price, and it is only acquired through an immeasurable extent of determination, resilience, discipline, practice. And for me to constantly want to lift up my head and see how close I am to the destination, number one, I will not enjoy that process as much as I should. It's like going on a road trip with your family. We definitely did this a lot when we were kids. Going on a road trip and then your dad is, you know, actively trying to take the most entertaining, enjoyable, picturesque route to that destination, and he'll point out, you know, the flock of birds flying, migrating from one spot to the other, a herd of, I don't know, wild deers. Do deers travel in herds? I suck at this. Sheep, goat, grazing, lush, green, beautiful, dense grass, clouds in the sky, the blue hue of the morning glistening sky. And then all you can do as a kid is ask, "Are we there yet? Are we there yet? Are we there yet?" That journey is going to be so grotesque, so boring, so painful for you and your parents. Constantly asking, "Are we there yet?" Losing sight of all the beautiful bounties, all the beautiful sceneries, all the interesting things that we could experience, we are being exposed to yet neglecting at this moment. I'm not saying that children, you know, I'm not addressing children at all on this show. I'm not telling the six-year-old sitting in the back seat of their dad's car, probably slightly nauseous, to, you know, live in the moment and do yoga, meditate. I'm addressing ourselves, the children of yesterday. That if we are parents, we should try different methods to create that state of awareness in our kids, help them to develop the sense of living in the moment and being present, enjoying the process and the journey. And of course, as adults, it's never too late to start. The path toward wisdom is almost, or in other words, acquiring wisdom is almost one of the reasons of our existence, if we interpret wisdom as ma'rifatullah, gaining knowledge regarding Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and by doing so getting closer to Him, regarding which we have countless ahadith. I don't think there's anything more emphasized on than acquiring knowledge and wisdom in Islam. Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam, the wisest person in the history of wise people, says to us that go acquire knowledge even if it's in China. And mind you, China was a really far away land 1400 years ago from the Arabic Peninsula for people, a bunch of people who had to travel by camel and camel alone. Right now, we might think that, well, China is just a flight away, except, well, it's locked down and we can't travel. But the point is that even if it's in the farthest point region in the world, there is some sort of precious, authentic wisdom. Putting our energy and effort into attaining it would not be a waste. In fact, it is admirable and it is rewarded in Islam. In fact, it is encouraged. And by this, we are constantly going through the process of growth, which is the most innate quality of any living creature. And in accordance with their potential, the degree of growth they experience is higher. Thankfully for you, we're all out of time. Inshallah, if you'd like, kindly join us on another episode of The Lantern. Until then, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanallah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.